welcome listeners to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, here with you every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a longstanding journalist and advocacy promoter of health, food, and the environment, all of the things we need for that, and for society, communities, public policy, and a habitable earth, all the things we need to sustain life. Every week on Connect the Dots, I speak with different experts, advocates, authors, pioneers, visionaries, thought leaders, a lot of terrific people addressing different segments of all of the things that we need to gain more understanding about and what we need to transform to create a more healthy and sustainable society and planet. So thank you so much for joining me for this edition of the show. This is actually the fifth in a series that we've had and running, I think it will be ending next week, of different speakers who were participating in the technological utopia teach-in that occurred a couple of weeks ago at Cooper Union. And today's guest is someone who's going to be presenting another event, which I'm very excited about, and it's one of the reasons why, you know, because we kind of get to continue the same understandings and deepen our wisdom about the same topics. I'm a little distracted by an echo I'm hearing on my line here. Hopefully the engineer, oh, he just took care of that. Thank you. No, it's still there, unfortunately. Oh, well, we'll see. Hope you're not hearing it. In any case, our guest today is presenting a terrific program this coming weekend at the same venue. That's Cooper Union in New York. If you're in the New York area, Northeast area, or anywhere else in the country and are able to come, I hope you will. We'll be talking about that more in the program. And this is all part of our continuity of looking at bigger picture things that we need to change our world. Today's guest is Helena Norberg-Hodge. She's a pioneer of the new economy movement. This is something that I'm really deeply grateful for, that there is a pioneering woman thought leader who can really look at the big picture in terms of global economies and what we all need to shift, change, and support so that we have a more sustainable way of operating here on the planet and one that is more just and inclusive. And that's what we'll be talking about on today's show. Helena has been promoting an economics of personal, social, and ecological well-being for more than 30 years. In 2012, she earned the prestigious GOI Peace Prize, I hope I pronounced that correctly, for her work in Ladakh. She also received the Right Livelihood Award, a kind of alternative Nobel Prize. Her seminal book, Ancient Futures, has been described as an inspirational classic. There's also a film of the same name, Ancient Futures, and it's been translated into more than 40 languages. Helena Norberg-Hodge is a producer of the award-winning film The Economics of Happiness and co-author of Bringing the Food Economy Home and From the Ground Up, Rethinking Industrial Agriculture. This is a topic very familiar to our listeners, because we've regularly covered food and food agriculture issues, GMOs. You know, we just had some GMO referendums in the election, and I should also, you know, say for anyone listening to this show in the future that we're listening in the aftermath of yesterday's election, the 2014 election. So, you know, there's a lot that's going to be timely on this show, which means that later we'll be kind of looking back at what was going on at this point in time, and I can't really imagine a more relevant thing to be talking about or a better person to be informing our understanding about that. So let me, I could go on and on with her incredibly impressive and fantastic resume, but I want to give her ample time to speak and also encourage those who are free this weekend to carve out this coming Saturday to attend her event sponsored by Local Futures, her organization. So welcome to Connect the Dots, Helena.
Thank you. Very happy to be here. I can't think of a better topic than connecting the dots for the big picture. That's what I'm all about.
Yes, thank you. Well, you know, it's funny because the term has been around for a while, and actually the producers of my radio program, which we're coming up on 4 years here on the Progressive Radio Network, you know, the young producers named the show, and it always had an environmental context, but really it just keeps going on and on because it connects to everything. And one of the things that I am really thrilled about is talking about the economic aspect with you today, because it's something that I think many women feel very disempowered, and many people indeed overall feel very disempowered to address. There are these large grinding economic forces that seem to rule our lives, that rule our philosophy and outlook. You know, how do we get a handle on them? We've been told that making some consumer choices can make a difference. Obviously, that doesn't seem to be quite enough. Today, you know, we're dealing with the aftermath of the election yesterday, where we saw money invade in many different directions, both in political campaigns as well as in two important referendums on the right to know what's in our food through labeling GMOs that were occurring in Colorado and Oregon. And I don't know that we have final results. I think we have results on one state but not on the other, but money played a big role there. So I think, you know, money in economics is something that people feel very disempowered by and unable to get a handle on almost anything, because that's always there. Such an important factor in our society and our global economy. So I'm hoping you can give our listeners some direction, some hope. But first of all, share with us a bit your perspective on whether we really can find a way to intervene, participate, and change the way our economic structures are driving things in our world.
Yes. Absolutely. I think we can intervene. I think that we are now, partly because the crises are so serious, we are getting very, very close to the point where we will muster the strength and the courage and the wisdom and the access to the big picture to see how we can change things and why it would actually be relatively easy. In practical terms, what we need to do is easy compared to what our government leaders are dragging us into, which is actually extremely expensive, extremely destructive of people, of nature, of democracy, of health, of everything we care about. So for that reason, we now have a potential for creating a very broad coalition that, instead of focusing on protecting the Amazon, protecting the dolphins, reducing CO2 emissions, protecting the poor, trying to help the homeless and the unemployed, fighting to maintain democracy. I mean, the list goes on. It's an absolutely endless list of things that we need to protect and deal with. But we're not asking often enough, what is it we're protecting everything from? What is it that has gone so wrong that almost everything we care about is threatened? And that is basically what, you know, what I and my network, a global network, what we are talking about. And I think the main reason why we've been so lost is that in order to really see things clearly, I think we need a global perspective. And what I've discovered is that, generally speaking, the people who are operating from a global perspective are looking at the world from the top down. And they tend to be narrowly focused experts or, you know, government leaders, economic leaders, who all are absolutely convinced that growth through global trade is the only way to create jobs and is the way to maintain stability and security. Now, actually, as it turns out, what they call growth is making the majority poorer, and this is true across the board. It's true in China, it's true in Sweden, it's true in the United States. But we at the grassroots, who are so upset about poverty and so upset about the environment, are generally not questioning the global growth agenda, because we generally haven't been looking at it. We've been looking at our local or national problems. So I think that's what's needed is what I call big picture activism, big picture activism, where we realize that we have to see the bigger picture more clearly, and we need to get that out so that we deliver a clear agenda and spell out what we need to start the path towards healing both human health, societal health, ecological health, democratic health. And really what we need is to move away from subsidizing and supporting giant banks and corporations. Now, people, they know that the problem has a lot to do with big banks and corporations, but they were not paying attention generally to the path whereby these banks and corporations gained so much power and influence. And that was through trade treaties, through so-called free trade. And these treaties are right now continuing to accelerate the destruction. The latest treaties are called TTIP, Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, between Europe and North America. And another one is called TPP, Trans-Pacific Partnership. And it sounds very nice with partnerships, doesn't it? But these treaties are now, thank goodness, getting a little bit of public exposure. They make it essentially illegal for our governments to protect our environments or our citizens. They are saying that if you do anything to in any way reduce the profit making of a foreign corporation or of banks, you will be sued. The government will be sued by big business. So
yeah, so this is like, in effect, putting a huge super government over our government. So, you know, whatever rights that we have to participate locally in our community, in our state, in our region, and nationally, there'll now be another overarching level that we can't very easily access if these treaties go through. And in fact, I just want to refer our listeners who may not have tuned in at the time. We did a whole month on these treaties back in March, back in May rather. We had speaker after speaker every Wednesday discussing different aspects of them. And I think that I don't know if there'll be so much activity in the lame duck Congress that's coming up over the next 2 months trying to sneakily pass these bills. As had been anticipated now following these elections, where they probably would have a better shot after the new elected officials come in. But in any case, I just want to underscore to our listeners, it's extremely important to look out for and take action on these issues, because this is like an uber, you know, all the people who are like going hands off government, we don't want government in, they're bringing in a uber level that is not accountable to the public in any way in any country if these treaties pass. So just want to underscore that. Hugely
yeah.
important. What can people do?
Main thing, I think, is if people could have clarity about the fact that so many people at the local level, you know, businesses particularly, have ended up immensely frustrated by bureaucracy, by regulations that often make it impossible for them to function. And it's been, you know, it's been very clear, particularly in farming, all kinds of regulations brought in that, you know, mean that a farmer who's got 10 chickens on an acre of land has got to have the same health inspection, the same expenses as a chicken factory farm with maybe a million chickens. Mm-hmm. Now, what's happened is that many of the smaller players have ended up totally furious at government, like the Tea Party. This is happening in other countries as well. They see the hand of government, but they haven't seen that behind that is the hand of big business, and it's the hand of big global banks and businesses that are not named, that we can't vote for. And so this, you know, the process you're talking about, this sort of uber government, as it were, is actually governed by banks and corporations that are pressuring governments in the direction of creating profit for them. Now, I also just want to stress that many of the people in those businesses who push for global deregulation are not totally, I mean, in many cases, the ones I've spoken to, are really not aware of the huge damage they're doing. They are just, you know, in their job, and if they don't grow their company, they're going to be axed, and they're just sort of blindly running in the direction of freedom, free trade, global economy, globalization, and we at the grassroots have not been clear enough, not been strong enough to really articulate what this means, and that is what we need to do urgently, really urgently. And just as you said, Alison, I find that so many women tend to shy away from this issue because it feels very abstract, it feels so big, it feels like, oh, we can't do anything about it. But as I said earlier, we're now at the point where we could build a really powerful coalition of all those people who are worried about their health, who are worried about poverty, who are worried about climate change, who are worried about war, who are worried about women's rights, who are worried about migrants. I mean, there's a huge potential for a huge, broad coalition. And the huge, broad coalition is taking Occupy onto a level not just of saying what we're against, but of saying what we're for, and being clear that for all of those issues, we have to decentralize or localize economic activity. And that, you know, again, to think this through, I mean, I hope people will watch our film, The Economics of Happiness. I hope they will look out for Russell Brand. Do you know Russell Brand, Alison?
Oh, of course, yes. Mm-hmm.
Well, he's written a book, actually, where he quotes me extensively. It's called Revolution. Mm-hmm. And I love the fact that, I don't know if you've seen, have you seen the cover? I mean, he's turned the L around in Revolution, so it says love. And he, like Chris Hedges, you know, who will be speaking at our Cooper Union meeting on Saturday, they both are totally committed to nonviolence, which I think is absolutely essential, that we clearly, clearly commit to nonviolence. And so his revolution is partly a revolution of love. It's a revolution of rebuilding our connections to one another, to the earth. It's a spiritual revolution as much as it's a political revolution, an economic revolution. And that is really, you know, what I'm talking about. And I'm so glad that his book, he's reaching a lot of people, and he's had me on his web thing. He's got something called Truths, you know, True News. And I was on there recently, and that's, you know, reaching quite a few people. But anyway, we need voices like that.
Let me just interject here for people to be able to find your resources, find the film, your books, and the event. Helena's website is localfutures.org. Now, it's a terrific and very succinct and easy to find. You'll find out more about her work. You can find the things that she has done, as well as the upcoming event. Helena mentioned Chris Hedges. You mentioned Chris Hedges is going to be at the event. Now, this is a real opportunity, I want to say. I've heard Chris Hedges speak many, many times at Occupy, I don't know how many times, and elsewhere, follow his writings, read his books and all. But, you know, people, if you're in, you know, accessible and have a free day this coming Saturday, November 8th, from 10 to 6 p.m., you're going to have a wonderful opportunity, very reasonably priced, to hear Chris Hedges, as well as some other terrific participants, Charles Eisenstein, Michael Schumann, a whole host of really terrific people at this event. And if you're not in the area but support this work, I also urge you to go to the sign-in on localfutures.org. It'll take you to a link. If you just click on the big banner on the site, and if you're not in the area but you're also really interested and find this work important, I also urge you to contribute. You can. You know, I was one of the first, probably the first reporter on the Huffington Post that was not only reporting the news but also linking to activism to engage people, invite people to get involved, give everyone a way to participate in our world and making the changes that we need to stay healthy and keep our families and future generations healthy. And now I'm actually, for the first time on this show, I'm actually planning a future show on fundraising. I'm doing some direct appeals because, you know, these organizations that are working so hard on our behalf don't come about, just by accident or, you know, because somebody has a trust fund or something. There's a lot of hard work behind it. And part of participation is voting and getting involved on a local level, making right economic choices, as we'll learn more about as we continue this conversation with Helena Norberg Hodge. But also, it's supporting, even with a few dollars, the organizations that are doing, the work that's on all our behalf. So, and if you can come to the event, that's great. And I will be there and look forward to seeing you. So please, listeners, do let me know via my Facebook page, Connecting the Dots for Health, if you'll be coming. All right. This is all so incredibly important. What will be the thrust of the event, Voices of Hope in a Time of Crisis, this next Saturday? What is your goal for that?
The thrust is really to throw open a much bigger picture analysis. And so I'm really happy that Chris, as a voice from the left, is also embracing this localized perspective, because unfortunately many people on the left have not, I have to say, from my point of view, understood the deeper ecological, spiritual, community issues from a global perspective enough to embrace localization. The corporate message is that local food, you know, especially local organic food, is this elitist, you know, white middle class priority, which is absolutely goes against caring about the poor. Well, they have not been looking clearly enough at the way that governments from both left and right are subsidizing global trade, and by doing that, they're subsidizing the global traders. They're actually subsidizing McDonald's and Monsanto and the giant, big monocultures that are actually less efficient, small diversified farms, employing more people, produce more food per acre. This is really, it's like number one on an agenda of rethinking our assumptions and rethinking the global economy. We have to realize that food is actually the central part of our economic system. We often just think of, you know, the economy as money, but basically we have to, you know, with the bigger picture, we have to step back and realize it's about how we produce what we need and how it happened that we ended up from both left and right subsidizing big and global. It goes back hundreds of years, the origins, and it started with slavery. It's a rotten system, but we actually have to go beyond a common anti-capitalist critique to get to the a picture that is actually so much more hopeful and so much, it's so inviting, because once we sort of take away some of these basic assumptions and we see that what we need to do, it can simultaneously massively reduce CO2 emissions and increase employment. The people being employed, it absolutely does not mean increasing CO2 emissions and pollution when you do it in a non-corporate way and often in a non-industrial way. And it does not mean standing in some giant monoculture as a migrant worker or a slave of hundreds of years ago. You can see the new world by looking at some of the new trends in the local food movement, in the local economy movement, where you see people working on smaller farms or smaller restaurants, smaller businesses, where the work is so much more enjoyable than it is being, you know, a cog in a wheel in a giant system. Mm-hmm. So, and this is something that becomes, you know, much more obvious when you watch what's happening in China or India over the last 20 years, and you see, you know, right before your eyes, as I did, you know, to start with in Ladakh or Little Tibet, and also in Bhutan, where I worked over a five-year period, going back and forth. And so my eyes were open to all of this from these places in the Himalayas that hadn't been colonized and that had been closed off in the modern era of development. The modern era is sort of started with the setting up of the World Bank, the IMF, and the GATT, which was the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade. And it was that element that people did not pay enough attention to, this whole process of trade treaties. Now, in that modern era, the world was transformed into producing four giant corporations in a way that was reinforced by the IMF and the World Bank. And the IMF and the World Bank were essentially making sure that all economic activity came under one umbrella. Many of the people who promoted that believed it was necessary in order to avoid another depression. Mm-hmm. But in actual fact, by handing over the power to giant corporations and banks, we started on a path that was just hugely destructive economically, environmentally, politically. And so the whole issue that we're looking at has to do with scale, has to do with decentralizing or localizing. And what's so wonderful is that from the bottom up, totally without help from government, without help from mainstream media, there is now a global localization movement that is demonstrating these huge benefits, both environmental, social, and spiritual. Because at the center of all of this has to do with rebuilding the fabric of community, the social fabric, where people have more connection with each other. And by the way, I'm sure, you know, you're familiar with all of this, but, you know, more and more psychologists are realizing that those connections are essential for healthy self-esteem. They're essential for reducing depression, addiction, you know, Alcoholics Anonymous. One of the main pillars of their work is building community. So from my point of view, almost all the ills we face, including a sense of loneliness, a loss of self-esteem, eating addictions, you know, all the personal anxiety are connected actually to this global corporate economy. But we haven't seen the connections. Once we do, I think we're going to see, you know, just a wave of transformation.
But, you know, I couldn't agree more. And as someone who has participated from day one, really, in the self-help, healthy movement, I've been a promoter, a writer about that, writer of best-selling health books, and have spoken to the health audience. That's why I'm here in Progressive Radio to begin with. That's my deep background. And, you know, there's something terrific in that individual empowerment and starting at the individual level. And this is really growing that sense of initiative that movement has given us and extending it further into really extending things in our world so that the individual work that we do within ourselves is also seamless and integrated and interconnected with the world that we are living in, rather than it kind of being an isolationist, how can I take care of myself, but meanwhile these larger looming forces are out of my control, so it's all about how I personally have to handle my attitudes in relationship to them. That is basically a kind of victimized stance, you know.
It is.
And yet many of us have been encouraged in that and have been disempowered and told that's all that we can do and that's the best that we can do. And my feeling, and this is as, you know, kind of someone who's been a leader in communications and understanding in the health movement, is that we need to really expand that into our communities and into our social arenas and recognize and not be afraid, either because of the fear it evokes or the anger it evokes or the worry it evokes, to look at how these larger forces are actually working against us and our health in the way that you describe. And I think we have a tremendous opportunity, you know, if we do that, if we get involved. And we all know that, you know, it's healthier to have a diversification of different vegetables than just to eat iceberg lettuce. And so, this, you know, for example, everyone into health knows that. And that's the very reason that we need biological diversity in our whole environment. We need diverse sources of food. We get our food from healthier, smaller sources. Usually the quality is is better, the diversity is better, and that same basic principle that operates for our health and our food, that's an economic principle.
Exactly.
Even though we don't think of it as an economic principle, what Helena here is saying is that, in fact, it is, and we're already functioning as economic beings in that context, and we have a grounded understanding from these areas, and now we can kind of deepen that and do more as a way of addressing these bigger issue problems that are impacting everyone. Now, we're going to have to take a little break. I'll get off my little soapbox here, and we're going to take a little break for station identification, and then we'll be coming back to this wonderful conversation we're having with Helena Norberg-Hodge. And please stay with us, listeners, and, you know, like social media text and pass it along to a few friends during the break, and we'll be right back with more about this. Welcome back again, listeners, to the second half of Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, health, food, and environmental reporter, advocate, and general rabble-rouser in the health, food, and environmental sectors. We're talking today and getting educated about how to get our hands around the economy on a local and global level with guest Helena Norberg-Hodge, and we're also featuring her upcoming event, Voices of Hope in a Time of Crisis, this coming Saturday, November 8th, 10 to 6 p.m. in New York City, with a terrific roster of guests. You're warmly invited to come. We'll be talking a little bit more about the guests later in the show. And also, Helena is helping us get our minds and our hands around what we can do to shift these outsized economic forces that seem to be driving the bus. And we're all kind of, you know, there's a sense of how can I get out of this, I'm trapped, what can I do? You know, we've been talking about local solutions that Helena, who's studied and promoted this and built communities around this over the last number of years, is a real expert on. We'll talk about this more on the show. Let's just take a pause here and talk a little bit about who we have coming up in your event. I noticed that Chris Hedges will be speaking, as we discussed in the first part of the show. Michael Schumann will be speaking. I'm very interested in his work. Could you give our listeners just a little highlight of what he'll be talking about in your event this coming Saturday?
Yes, he's a lawyer and economist who for more than 20 years has been promoting local, going local. And he's focused on local finance, helping to find ways for smaller businesses and communities to strengthen themselves. And he's had huge success. I mean, there are many very, very inspiring examples. And again, I just want to stress that this is not about some narrow selfishness. We are approaching this from a global point of view, and we're seeing that all around the world, it's in every community's interest to try to keep businesses in the local area that respect the local environment, respect the local community, and a fabric of smaller businesses to produce most of our needs would solve most of our problems. I mean, this is how we can globally, massively reduce CO2 emissions. But it's the area that we've not been talking about. We've been talking about, you know, change your light bulbs, don't drive your car. Complete nonsense. You know, this represents, systemically, it's completely insignificant. What is significant is how government has been subsidizing big business to literally produce on one side of the world and ship across the world in larger and larger quantities. I mean, most countries import and export the same product. And we're talking about the U.S. exporting 900,000 tons of beef and turning around and importing about 900,000 tons of beef annually. The
That's
U.K.
crazy.
Exporting as much butter and milk as it imports. We're talking about things being flown. So going local, Michael is one of the people who's focused on the finance part of it. And some of our other speakers, like Judy Wicks, wonderful, inspiring woman who started a local business alliance. It's called BALE, Business Alliance for Local Living Economies. And these networks now in the United States, it involves about 30,000 businesses, but this model has also gone global. And I want to stress that on Saturday at Cooper Union, we're launching our International Alliance for Localization. This is now formalizing the networks of people that we've been working with for a long time. And so we have Manish Jain from India coming to speak. Now, he ended up graduating from Harvard and worked, I think, at Goldman Sachs and for the UN. And he realized that these dominant institutions are all promoting the same thing. Even when it sounds progressive, even when it sounds, you know, that it's coming from the left, it's a top-down system that, in the combination of big business and big government bureaucracy, destroys community, destroys smaller, healthier businesses, starting with healthy agriculture, healthy fishery, healthy forestry, gets destroyed, and you get giants promoting big monocultures, which is death to ecosystems and involves toxic chemicals, et cetera, et cetera. So he realized that this system was absolutely not working, and he went back to learn from his illiterate grandmother in India.
Wow.
And he has got an institute in India, you know, called Rethinking Education and Development. We have Bayo Akomolafe, who's a clinical psychologist from Nigeria, who has come to see that his Western-style education and the approach to psychology was, again, promoting a very sick isolation, individualism, and breaking down community. And above all, he came to see that this dominant system reduces non-Western cultures to feeling inferior, backward, and stupid. And so his, you know, his voice is very strong for really understanding the need to revitalize respect for cultural diversity, for diversity generally.
That's beautiful. That's very important. I just want to interject here for our listeners. You can go to localfutures.org to both click the banner there and find out more information about attending this wonderful gathering. And you can also find links to Helena's film, The Economics of Happiness, to her Ladakh project and other projects. So this is a great kind of thing. I also just have to say, too, as a New Yorker, you know, I really love the way you're talking about this is not just, I think one of the things that happens with localization, again, speaking as an urban resident, and I also spend a lot of time in the country as well, but there's a sense of, well, we have to go up, have a farm, have my organic garden there. If I am so economically blessed, fortunate, as to be able to have the skills and the means to do that. And yet, masses of people in our society reside in urban areas. Our food still comes from these agricultural areas. So part of this has been realizing where, in fact, our food is coming from and supporting the areas and the kinds of agriculture that provide the healthy food, which is one of the reasons that I've been on this show for years hammering about why we don't want to frack oil or send pipelines through our region. Both it affects communities, it affects water, it affects air quality and that travels. It also affects our food supply. So one of the things that I love about what you're describing is it's not just like an urban dweller has to like flee the city and go running off to a farm and that's the only option, which is not something a lot of people practically can do. Through the kinds of local businesses and initiatives you're talking about, this sounds like something that anyone can participate no matter where they're living, whether it's a rural, suburban, or urban area, or whatever country they're living in.
Absolutely. And, you know, I mean, people think that local means, you know, just, yeah, going back, and not just going back to the country, but most people in the West think of local communities as being these backwaters where there's a lot of prejudice and a lot of injustice. I mean, in fact, even, you know, for many people on the left, if you say localization, they immediately bring up things like slavery, and they assume that just because you have smaller businesses, you're suddenly going to have lots of prejudice and injustice. It's really quite illogical. I mean, part of the problem is that people don't realize that once you scale things up, the problem is that we don't even see the slave owners of the modern economy. We don't see these people who are earning billions and the trillions of dollars that are going around in this speculative casino. There is not even a recognition either from them of the poverty and pollution they're creating on the ground, or from us, we don't see the exploiters, you know. So it's the fact that you reduce the scale actually makes business, and including investment, including banking, more human scale, so that you actually see the people that you're lending money to or the people you're borrowing from. It makes the system more accountable and visible. And then, yes, you can see the exploitation and the corruption more easily, but that's also what is a prerequisite for dealing with it. I don't know, you know, some of these issues have to be, you know, thought through for a while, but what the main message I guess I would have is that I've seen, even in Sweden, where I'm from originally and where I grew up, I've seen even in Scandinavia that the corporate, and by corporate we need to remember that includes the banks, the way the system has changed in the last 30 years. I've actually been doing this for 40 years. But wow, the changes are really dramatic in the last 30 years. Even in Scandinavia, governments are no longer listening to their people. The trend is for the wars, for genetic engineering, for the large-scale corporate way of doing things, and the end result is greater poverty, greater pollution, greater unhappiness. This is why I call also the turn towards the local, the economics of happiness. But I want to stress again, we're talking about going local globally. We are talking about, as we are doing on Saturday, launching this international alliance, we're talking about an international movement and an international dialogue. We're talking about international collaboration, both at the level of non-profit grassroots organizations and at the level of government to solve our problems. So localizing in this sense is about the economic systems, and in order to get there we need collaboration, international collaboration. So I hope that makes sense.
Well, let's give a concrete example of that. Like, what would that look like in terms of an example from the United States of where somebody is doing that, like, you know, getting a little, let's get down in the dirt with it a little bit more.
Yeah. Yes. Well, let's say at the level of nonprofits, it will look a lot like what we have done in my organization, for instance, is to invite community leaders from the so-called third world, or, you know, so-called poor world, to actually come to see with their own eyes what's happening in the West, to talk to people here and to see our efforts to create something that's more community-based, more sustainable, and working. Now, this is so important because over there they are getting bombarded with images that make them feel that they're stupid and backward, and they're being bombarded with images basically of, you know, you've got to look like a Barbie doll, you've got to, you know, be white and Western, and what's being held up is the sort of urban consumer culture with a nuclear family in the, you know, with their all their you know, gadgets and their big cars and so on. That's presented as happy success. They don't hear about the fact that we have unemployment. They don't hear about the fact that there's massive pollution. They don't hear about the unhappiness. So getting a realistic picture of the West is a way in which they can connect with people in the West who are working for something that is truly more sustainable. And it turns out that we both share the same goals. You know, it doesn't mean we want the same model, but we realize that the dominant system that's promoting these consumer culture images is harmful to both the West and to them. Another way it's been, you know, this sort of international dialogue is very important for people from the West to come out, which we've had a program in Ladakh where they can actually live with the family and see the world from that perspective and learn, among other things, that traditional people who have more extended family, who have more human scale, economic activity are not these poor, backward, stupid people that we are led to believe.
I think this cross-cultural dialogue is really vital and so fascinating, but I also want our listeners to come away with an understanding of how, you know, a local way of organizing business would work on the ground in their community here.
Yeah.
If you could provide an example of that,
sure.
I think that would be helpful.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Well, there are so many examples. Like, for instance, just setting up a farmer's market is something really, really important, and it's something that actually my organization started promoting also in the United States about 30 years ago. And at that time, a lot of people say, oh, no, I like to have my, strawberries in January. Don't tell me to eat local. You know, I'm not interested. I got a lot of that. And even the farmers were not, even though they were often struggling, small farmers, they mm-hmm. just couldn't understand the idea of setting up a farmer's market. And there are several examples. One I can think of in England, especially that I was closer to, where a farmer's wife and some of us, still went ahead and just tried to persuade the farmers, tried to persuade the local government. And in the town where we were doing it, all the businesses were opposed to it. It was, it took probably, in that case, it took a couple of years to get it going. And on the first day, when finally some farmers had agreed, okay, and the businesses, the local government had agreed to let us have a place, and the businesses had sort of agreed, very reluctantly, it rained, and we thought, this is it, it's just not going to happen. But even in pouring rain, there was enough happening that the farmers and the consumers loved it. And from then, it just went from strength to strength. And in most parts of the world, even now in Beijing, there's a young guy who started a CSA, community-supported agriculture, and mm-hmm. people just love it. But in the meanwhile, we're not aware that this has all happened through blood, sweat, and tears from grassroots people working against the tide. So part of what we need to be looking at is getting out the message that going local is not just about you buying local, buying organic, mm-hmm. which is mm-hmm. often more expensive. Mm-hmm. We are saying, please get the message out that we don't want our tax dollars to subsidize old, dead food from 10,000 miles away costing less than fresh, local, organic food. If we shifted taxes and subsidies, literally within a year, we would see a huge difference in prices. And
what organizations are doing that? Like, how do people get involved? For example, a couple of years ago, I was reporting on the Food Safety Bill of 2010, which put in place the very policies on a national level and the subsidies that are working against us. I have a couple of pet organizations, but which I'll add into the mix. Do you have any where people can kind of go, to do that? I mean, I love the... I think it's essential because this is part of thinking from personal to local to global is to look at what's going on in national policy. But what are the, what organizations? Because usually organizations like yours and other nonprofits, those people that are out there shouting and we're going, oh, I get so many emails, they are the ones who are like spearheading these kinds of things.
Yeah,
so we need to follow them. We need to act. We need to, I would say that Citizens for Health, Food Democracy Now or two that are working on similar kinds of fronts in this regard. So we need to know the people. And in some cases, there aren't organizations. We need to support the organizations that are there.
Yeah. Exactly. I guess what I'm seeing is what, you were talking before about how this inner work, working with our health and how we need to move beyond that to see mm-hmm. the broader political and economic. In order to make that transition to big picture, to really big picture, we need to realize that, in a way, awareness is activism. And so mm-hmm. part of the problem has been to be looking for organizations that are, say, lobbying Washington. Mm-hmm. Right now, I want us to lobby those people who care about their health, who care about their mind. In other words, we need to reach out to the movements with awareness activism, or what I call big picture activism, mm-hmm. to create, That is an action that we try to become more informed. And what I'm saying is, please listen to this. You know, there is a way of seeing the world, of seeing yourself, that is far more hopeful than you believe. The dominant view has put you into a mass of assumptions that right now what I'm seeing happening is for many people, the set of assumptions we're getting lead us to say the human race is terrible. We are aggressive and greedy, and we deserve to extinguish ourselves. That's what I'm hearing. And that's all because of misinformation. Our problem is not human nature. Our problem is a system that pits people against each other, that pits them against their own true nature. It's a system that overnight almost we can change it by changing our attitudes and by opening up our hearts and our minds to the deep belief that by nature, every child that's born longs for love and connection, and that even as adults, that's what we're looking for. I saw firsthand in Tibet, in Ladakh and Bhutan, I saw how media images injected themselves in children's minds as young as 3 and 4. Now, I need to start by saying that I had never encountered people who seemed happier, more content, more relaxed, just radiant than these people. When I arrived in this place called Ladakh, it had been sealed off from the outside world, and it was suddenly thrown open to development and the global economy. I learned to speak the language fluently. I was a linguist, and I got to know these people that were just, as I say, well, I met the Dalai Lama many times, and in the early years, he's the spiritual head there, too. But most people were like the Dalai Lama, just this sparkling humor and deep ease and self-esteem. I saw how that got changed by the global economy, and I saw it going through children. Children are very vulnerable. They soak up these images and ideas. The message to the child was, if you want to be loved and accepted by your peer group, you've got to have the latest running shoes. You've got to have the latest iPad. You've got to have the latest this. And the child goes down that path, basically seeking love and acceptance, and ends up a source of envy and separation. Now, when your child comes to you and says, I've got to have the latest iPad, I've got to be on my, you know, I've got to be on Facebook, you know, the whole day long, for you to say no as an individual is very difficult because you feel like, you know, you're cutting them off from their community. But we have to realize that this system is making community something toxic. You know, this whole Facebook experience now, they're realizing that a lot of teenagers, when they get off Facebook, feel more depressed because they've internalized what the media was doing. And now it's a question of, oh, my friends were having a better weekend than I was. Oh, don't they look more sexy and beautiful in their photos? It's internalizing the system of competition and separation. Now, but we have to realize all of these things have come out of a growth mentality from our political leaders on both left and right, out of a belief that this is how we create jobs when it actually destroys them, out of a set of assumptions that are not that difficult to tear apart once we start looking at them. So we need the big picture activism, need to connect the dots. And one of the things that I recommend is that people try to connect with a few like-minded people and meet up regularly. Really search out like-minded people. If you can, if you have children in school, try to meet some other parents. Try to create a group effort to step out of this competitive consumer culture.
I think it's a wonderful suggestion. I just want to reiterate that this coming weekend you can hear Helena in person along with her other guests and people who will be presenting at her event, Voices of Hope in a Time of Crisis. taking place in New York City this Saturday, November 8th, 10 to 6 p.m. at Cooper Union downtown. You can find out more information and sign up to go, and I will be there. Please come greet me if you're a Connect the Dots listener or if you're not, at www.localfutures.org. We're rounding out here to near the end of our program. It's just been totally delightful having you on here, Helena, and hearing the holism of your perspective and what you carry. Actually, what you're also saying is, like, on the local level, we kind of begin. And, you know, it's funny. I notice the same thing. I actually do a lot of work online on Facebook, my blogging, my social media dissemination. It's important in terms of engaging people and getting the word out. But it's also important to do to attend these events in person, meet one another. I'm going to be meeting a Facebook friend for the first time at your event, because we're both going to it, as well as in one's local community. And you know, when people get really caught up in getting by, succeeding, you know, coping with the stresses of this particular society and culture, where we're kind of ground central for these attitudes that you're describing, that are now spreading all over the world, it becomes almost like people get too busy, and especially in a place like New York, everybody just is kind of running their own race. And one of the things that I feel is really important, and that this whole movement toward local community has kind of empowered me to do, is to just say, I want to build my friendships with people I know here. And instead of just saying to somebody, well, let's get together. Yes, let's get together. And then no one gets together, you know. Then if you're the person who says a second time, let's get together, then you become the loser because you're not as driven and busy as the next person, you know.
And also,
be open-hearted and say, you know, we need more friends. We need more community. And to do that and with people and invite them to events like this. So please come to this event. Bring a friend. Thank you, Helena, for being with us. I hear our Connect the Dots music of Bobby McFerrin winding us that our show is coming to a close here. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And I will see you this weekend.
Thank you. Lovely to meet you.
Yes, and we'll meet more there in person. Thank you, listeners. Come out to the event and tune in next week at 10 a.m. Wednesday Eastern Time for Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy. Be well. Have a great week.